Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, with a variety of meats for grilling, roasting, and meal prepping. Harmon's, your food, our passion.
The British writer Johann Hari begins his latest book with a story about a party, a fancy one.
It was in the winter of 2022, and it was that moment when the world was opening up again after everything we've been through. And for the first time in, I don't know, 2 years, I got invited to a party. And I immediately said yes. It was in the home of an Oscar-winning actor. I'm not saying that just to name drop, it's relevant. And in the Uber on the way to the party, I suddenly had this awful sinking feeling. You know, I'd gained quite a lot of weight during lockdown, and I'd been quite fat at the start. And I thought, oh, I felt a bit schlubby and embarrassed. And then suddenly I thought, oh, wait a minute, almost everyone I know has gained weight during lockdown. This party's going to be really interesting because I'm going to see these Hollywood stars with like a bit of weight on them. They're going to be a bit flabby. This is going to be super fascinating. And I arrived and I started to walk around the party, and it was the weirdest thing. It's not just that no one had gained weight. Everyone was gaunt. Everyone was markedly thinner than they had been before. And I don't just mean the stars. Their partners, their kids, the agents, the screenwriters. Everyone looked like their own Snapchat filter, you know, like kind of cleaner and clearer and sharper. And I was in a bit of a daze. I bumped into a friend of mine on the dance floor. And I said to her, wow, looks like everyone really did take up Pilates during lockdown. And she laughed, and I didn't understand why she was laughing. And she crinkled her brow and said, well, you know it's not Pilates, right? I had no idea what she was talking about, and she pulled up on her phone an image of an Ozempic pen. And that was when I learned that we now have a new kind of weight loss drug that works in a totally new way. It's not a fad, it's not a craze. It's a huge scientific breakthrough. The average person who takes Ozempic or Wegovy loses about 15% of their body weight. The average person who takes Mounjaro, which is the next in this class of drugs, loses around 21% of their body weight. And the average person who takes Triple G, which will be available next year, loses 24% of their body weight. When I first learned that, I remember feeling immediately intensely conflicted. The first thing I thought was, well, this could save my life. I was about to turn 44, which is the age that my grandfather was when he died of a heart attack. I knew even then, I think, that obviously obesity makes heart disease much more likely. It actually makes over 200 known diseases or complications either more likely or worse when you get them. So I thought, well, if there really is a drug that can reduce or even reverse obesity, that's going to have huge consequences for health. But I also thought, wait a minute, this sounds way too good to be true. This has got to have some downside. So I went on a really deep journey into the science of Ozempic. I took it myself for a year. And what I learned is that the story about these drugs is actually quite complex. There's three ways these drugs could be magic. The first is the most obvious. They could just solve the problem, right? I don't overeat anymore. I've lost 42 pounds. It's staggering. The second way it could be magic is much more disturbing. It could be like a magic trick. It could be like a conjurer who shows you a card trick while they pick your pocket. There are 12 significant risks that come with taking these drugs. It could be that over time, these 12 big risks outweigh the benefits. The third way it could be magic is, I actually think, the most likely. Think about the stories of magic that we all grew up with. Think about, like, I know what would be a good example, Aladdin. You find the lamp, you rub it, the genie appears, he grants your wishes, and your wish comes true, but never quite in the way you expected. There's always cascading, unpredictable effects. I think we're already seeing that with these drugs. These drugs can do great good for some people, they can do terrible harm to other people. And they're going to transform the society in all sorts of unpredictable ways. We're already at the point where 47% of Americans want to take these drugs. given that 70% of us are overweight or obese, I think it's going to be more than that pretty soon when it's a daily pill and it's a dollar a day. So this is going to have massive consequences for all of us. I hope my book is a chance for us to stop and really think about what this is going to mean as we live through this incredible scientific revolution.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Johann Hari is with us today talking about his book. It's called Magic Pill. As he told us, the idea of the book isn't to endorse this new class of weight loss drugs, even though, as he points out, they are definitely working for him. But Hari found the more you look into this larger debate about obesity, the more complicated it gets. As he just said, Hari goes through the risks of Ozempic, that they could cause thyroid cancer or mess up your pancreas or shrink muscle mass. He explains Ozempic face and Ozempic butt. The book, though, is also about, as Hari puts it, how we got here to the point where obesity kills some 300,000 Americans a year and how nearly half of us are willing to inject ourselves with a drug to stop us from wanting to eat. We began the conversation with the inspiration for Hari's experience and his journey, his friend Hannah.
Hannah is the funniest person I ever knew. The first time we met, we sat next to each other at a really lousy play that was unbelievably bad, and everyone else was taking really seriously. And when we left the theater, we literally fell into each other's arms laughing. And essentially for the next 8 years, we did nothing but laugh, right? She was unbelievably witty. She was hugely overweight, and I was very overweight at the time, and we developed this running joke. We would go to like the skeeziest, grimmest, like diner, and we would review it like it was a Michelin-starred restaurant. We had a million running jokes. And when I was in my early 40s and she was in her mid-40s, she'd had a series of illnesses that were all made more likely by obesity. She had terrible back problems. When she had back surgery, she developed an addiction to opioids. She stopped taking opioids. She had heart problems. When she got COVID, she got it really, really badly. And then she had a heart attack and died. And when she died, all these running jokes we'd had all these years about obesity, like there's a place in Vegas and in Arizona called the Heart Attack Grill, not so far from where you guys are. And it's a place where you turn up and there's these huge scales outside, and if you weigh more than 350 pounds, you eat free. And when you go in, you sign a waiver saying if their food gives you a heart attack, it's on you, not on them. And there are waitresses dressed as nurses who spank you if you don't finish the enormous portions that you get. And when we first learned about this, we laughed and laughed, and we promised each other that we would go there one day. And after she died, I was in Vegas. And I went to the Heart Attack Grill thinking, oh, I'll toast our friendship in banana milkshake. And I went there and I just thought, the joke turned to dust in my mouth. You know, when you're young, the risks of obesity seem awfully abstract, right? Like, okay, you know, people are more likely to get heart attacks and strokes and dementia and cancer and all sorts of things. But, you know, it seems a very long way away. I'm in my mid-40s, don't seem far away anymore. And that really haunted me when I was facing the decision about whether to take the new weight loss drugs or not.
It's interesting because, I mean, you say it should have been a warning sign to you, but you kept on struggling with your own weight. And it really gets to this question you work through in the book about how did you get to this point? How did we all get to this point? That's what the book is in some ways. As much as it's about these drugs and the risks and benefits, it's about how we got to this point. Say something about that, because you work through that question a lot in the book.
I would just say to anyone listening, just stop for a moment, unless you're driving, please don't if you're driving, and just Google photographs of beaches near you in 1979, the year I was born, and just look at them for a moment. Right? When you look at them, they seem really odd to us because everyone in them appears to be skinny or jacked, right? By our standards, you look at it and go, well, where was everyone else on the beach that day? What's going on? Was it like a skinny person convention? And then you look at the figures. That's what Americans look like in 1979, the year I was born. We've lived through something completely incredible. Human beings existed in their modern form for about 350,000 years, and obesity existed, but it was extraordinarily rare. And then essentially in my lifetime, it has blown up. Go to one of those high schools or elementary schools where they keep the photos of classes going back years and years and years, and just look at the kids in like the 70s. They don't look like our kids, right? Between the year I was born and the year I turned 20, obesity doubled in the United States. And in the next 20 years, severe obesity doubled again. And you think, well, that's really strange. What happened? We know what happened. The science on it is very clear. This change happens everywhere that makes one transformation. It's where people move from mostly eating fresh whole foods they prepared on the day to mostly eating processed and ultra-processed foods, which means foods that are constructed out of chemicals in factories in a process that isn't even called cooking. It's called manufacturing food. And it turns out this new kind of food, which never existed before, your great-grandparents never ate it, affects our bodies in a completely different way to the old kind of food. And it undermines our ability to ever feel full and to feel like we've had enough. I'll give you an example of an experiment that really landed this for me. It was carried out by a brilliant scientist called Dr. Paul Kenny, who's the head of neuroscience at Mount Sinai in New York. It's a very simple experiment. He got a load of rats and he raised them in a cage. And all they had to eat was the kind of natural whole foods that rats evolved to eat over thousands of years, right? The kind of food that our great-grandparents ate. Except the rat version. When that was all they had, the rats would eat when they were hungry and they would stop when they were full. They seemed to have some kind of natural nutritional wisdom that meant they knew when they were full and stopped when they were. Those rats never became fat or overweight. Then Dr. Kenny introduced them to the American diet. Get ready to salivate, everyone. He bought a load of Snickers bars. He fried up some bacon. He crucially bought a load of cheesecake and he put it in the cage alongside the healthy food. And the rats went crazy for the American diet. They ate and ate and ate and ate and ate. They would literally dive into the cheesecake and eat their way out, completely kind of slicked with cheesecake. The way Dr. Kenny put it to me was within a couple of days, they were different animals. And within a few weeks, they were all severely obese, right? Whatever natural wisdom they'd had when they had the kind of food they evolved to eat, to stop, just completely vanished. Then Dr. Kenny tweaked the experiment again in a way that to me as a former junk food addict seems a little bit cruel. He took away the American diet and left them with nothing but the healthy food again. And he was sure he knew what would happen. They would eat more of the healthy food than they had at the start. And this would prove that exposure to junk food expands the number of calories you eat in a day. That is not what happened, Doug. What happened is much weirder. Once they'd been exposed to the American diet and it was taken away, they refused to eat any of the healthy food. It was like they no longer recognized it as food. They would rather starve than eat healthy food again. It was only when they were literally wasting away that the rats finally went back to eating the healthy food. Now, I've nicknamed that experiment Cheesecake Park. I would argue we are all living in a version of Cheesecake Park right now. The average American child, 67% of the calories they eat in a day come from ultra-processed foods, right? Foods built in factories that your great-grandparents would never have recognized. This is catastrophic. It's undermining our ability to ever feel full, which is what prepares the ground for these drugs.
I want to come back to the question of satiety here in a moment. Let me back up for a second, though, and ask you about what it is that the book is and what it does. First of all, you say right up front, the role isn't to champion these drugs. The role isn't to damn them either. What is the role that you want to play? You mentioned you're not a scientist. You're a journalist. But there is a personal component in here, the story of Hannah, your own kind of experience. So what did you want the book to be in that sense?
Yeah, for me, every book I ever write has to be an attempt to answer a mystery that I don't know the answer to at the start, right? So, you know, like you say, I'm a journalist. I was trained in the social sciences at Cambridge University, but I'm not a scientist, although I'm pretty good at reading science and understanding it. So for me, as soon as I learned about these drugs, you know, first I wanted to make the decision for myself. Should I take them?
Right.
Is it safe? What will it feel like? How will it be? Not just how will it feel physically, but how will it feel psychologically? Which is a much more complicated question than I expected at the start, actually. So for me, it was about what I hope I say to the reader is kind of come along on this journey of discovery with me, right? Mm. I'm genuinely open-minded on this. I could have come out at the end saying these were disastrous, or I could have come out at the end saying they were going to save us all. In fact, I came to a more complicated position, as you know. But for me, it's about going on a journey to get the answers that we need to know. Because look, this is going to change all of our lives, right? Mm. Everyone listening will love someone who's overweight or obese. And everyone listening will know someone very soon who's taking these drugs. And it's going to change the economy. It's going to change the society. It's going to change our bodies. It's going to change a lot of things. So I hope the book is a kind of guide for people to think about this incredible change that's beginning.
I want to jump to the point where you decide to take Ozempic. You say it in the book, it was quite abruptly you decided you should start taking the drugs. It was a snap decision. Mm. And you didn't understand the impulses that were really driving it at the moment. But let's talk about that first moment when you take Ozempic for the first time. And then take us to the morning after and that feeling that you had, that sense of something going on. What's it like to take Ozempic?
I'll never forget the second day after I injected myself. I was lying in bed and I woke up and I had this strange feeling and I couldn't locate what it was. You know, I feel when you wake up and you're coming around and you're not quite sure how you feel. Mm. And I was lying there for about 5 minutes thinking, oh, this is weird. What do I feel? Because it was so unfamiliar. And then I realized I had woken up and I wasn't hungry. Normally, I would be woken up by a kind of raging hunger. I thought, huh, this is weird. Mm. So I went to this diner just up the street when I'm in London, where I used to go every morning here. And I ordered what I used to order every day, which I'm embarrassed to say was a giant chicken sandwich with loads of chicken and mayo in it. And normally, I would wolf that down and still want some potato chips. And I went in and I had like 4 mouthfuls of the sandwich and I felt full, really full. Mm. I couldn't eat anymore. And that's how it feels when you take these drugs, that the first and most striking and by far the biggest effect is that it's like shutters come down on your appetite. It's not like dieting. It's not like you're hungry, you want to eat, but you find a way to deny yourself. You feel really full, really fast. Mm. We know the primary mechanism by which this works. If you ate something now, Doug, doesn't matter what it is, after a little while, your pancreas will produce a hormone called GLP-1. And GLP-1 is part of your body's natural signals, just going, hey, Doug, you've had enough. Stop eating, right? It's the brakes, basically.
Yeah.
But natural GLP-1 only stays around in your system for a few minutes, and then it gets washed away. What these drugs do is they inject you with an artificial copy of GLP-1. That instead of sticking around for a few minutes, sticks around in your system for a whole week, which is why it has this incredible effect that you just feel really full really quickly. I realized, you know, my whole life I'd eaten predominantly processed and ultra processed foods overwhelmingly. Yeah. I don't think I had ever felt full before I took these drugs. Wow. I'd obviously felt stuffed. There'd had times when I'd eaten so much I couldn't eat anymore.
Right.
But I don't think I'd ever felt full in a deep way, which is a kind of like, you've had enough, stop now, right? You mentioned the word satiety. It's not a word we use that often in ordinary English, but you know, the feeling of being sated, we know what it means. It's when you feel like you've had enough and don't want any more, which is slightly different to not being able to bear anymore. I'd had that feeling plenty of times when I stuffed myself with KFC, but it was a very strange and quite disorientating sensation.
I wonder if, we'll talk more about the because you reveal these kind of doubts and sensations as you go along. It was really interesting you say that that you know a few people who have had these kind of near-death experiences and that their lives kind of flashed before them. And for you, you said when you decided to take Ozempic that you your culinary life kind of flashed before you, which I think led to this very complicated relationship you had with food, obviously, but also how food sort of figured in the family. This is part of the sort of – this is the personal part of the story that I find interesting. Do you mind talking about that?
Sure, sure. I grew up in a slightly strange family. My dad was a – my dad grew up in the Swiss mountains in a little village, and it was – at the time, literally had one of the healthiest food cultures in the whole world, right? Basically, you only ate food you had grown or killed yourself in my dad's village, right? Yeah. So it was as healthy as can be. And my mother was from a working class, Scottish, poor kind of slum, basically. And they were ahead of the curve in eating badly, right? You know, they were tired and they were, you know, this is the country that invented the deep fried Mars bar, right? Not a paragon of good health. And my parents, when I was growing up, you know, when they met on a floor of a nightclub here in London. And my dad spoke like 10 words of English and my mother only spoke English. And they had what my mother calls a series of one night stands, which I'll try to explain is not a concept that makes sense. If there's more than one of them, it's not a one night stand. And she got pregnant and they thought they had to get married. And really often she'll cry and say, he seemed so nice when I couldn't understand what he was saying. But they... they argued about many things when I was a child, but one of the things they clashed over is the food that me and my brother and sister ate. So my mother and my grandmother who lived with us, my mother's mother, fed us processed and ultra-processed food, right? That was the easiest thing to make. It was what they gave it to us with great love, right? Hmm. The day we got a microwave was literally the happiest day of my grandmother's life, right? And my dad was just absolutely sickened and enraged by this food. He didn't think it was food. And, you know, the culture my dad came from, it was not a culture where you tried to persuade children of things, right? It was a very aggressive, Germanic, authoritarian culture where you basically screamed at kids to do something and if they didn't do it, you hit them, right? That was the culture my dad grew up with. Mm. So there was this huge conflict over food where, you know, my dad was actually, in retrospect, his concerns about what we were eating were correct, although he had no way of communicating that in the way that I could understand, right? So he would try and kind of force fresh food on me, sometimes literally trying to force it into my mouth, while my mother and grandmother would sort of secretly sneak me the kind of unhealthy food. So it was, I mean, if you really wanted to give a kid a screwed up relationship with food, you'd probably start with that, right? Yeah. But like, so it wasn't ideal. But in a way, the conflict in my family was unusual in some ways. But actually, the really unusual thing about it is that someone was objecting to the change that happened, right? No, my dad was not objecting in the right way, but that change was happening with pretty much everyone, right? Most kids now in the United States eat the way I ate when I was a child.
Yeah.
And we forget just how recent that is, right? No human beings have ever eaten like this before, right? It's really, really unusual. We should still feel some of the shock that my father felt. We shouldn't process it in the way my father did, but we should still experience a lot of that shock because the way we're eating... Well, as Professor Gerald Mand, who designed the food label that's on all food in the United States and is now an adjunct professor at Harvard, says 678,000 Americans die every year as a result of obesity or food-related illnesses. Do you want to say that again? 678,000 Americans every year. Mm-hmm. Lots of people listening, this is what's going to kill you. You don't think about it that way. You don't think, oh, you think, you know, oh, my aunt died of cancer. You don't think, oh. But obesity is one of the biggest causes of cancer. You know, my uncle died of diabetes-related causes, right? But that's because he was obese. You go down the list of almost all the things we fear. They are, when it comes to health, they are much more made much more likely or much more severe by obesity. This is having a devastating effect on us, and it's a really, really recent phenomenon.
Johann Hari. His latest book is called Magic Pill, The Extraordinary Benefits and Disturbing Risks of the New Weight Loss Drugs. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, with a variety of meats for grilling, roasting, and meal prepping. Harmon's, your food, our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer Johann Hari. We're talking about his new book, about this new class of weight loss drugs that could have a profound effect on the diseases caused by obesity. Hari started taking Ozempic and writing a book about his conflicted feelings because Ozempic worked for him. But Hari says this is a mass experiment and he's just one of the guinea pigs. The book is called Magic Pill.
You write about how 6 months into this experience of taking Ozempic that you started to experience these two sensations, and I wanted to ask you about them. The first of the sensations was that you felt your body was shrinking, that you could, you know, feel you were losing weight. But the other sensation is what's really interesting, and that is you say that your mood was strangely muted. What's going on here?
It was really weird, and I wish I had been. It's one of the many things I wish I had known in advance. Happens to quite a lot of people. Not a majority, but quite a lot of people who take these drugs. So this bit is disputed, but there are some scientists who are concerned these drugs may be causing depression or even suicidal feeling in a minority of people who use them. Now, it wasn't that bad for me. I didn't become depressed or suicidal, but I did feel down. And I was thinking, this is really weird. Why is that? I'm getting what I want, right? I lost a huge amount of weight. My back pain went away. My neighbor's hot gardener hit on me. Loads of great things happened. Right. And yet, I did not feel better. There's a debate about why this may be happening to some people. So one theory is we know, and I know this from interviewing the cutting-edge neuroscientists, it's increasingly clear that these drugs primarily work not on your gut, but on your brain. So we know that there are GLP-1 receptors, not just in your gut, but in your brain.
Right.
So maybe this is a brain effect. Maybe the drugs work, and this is highly disputed. We don't really know what they're doing to your brain. But one theory is they may be dampening your reward systems. So maybe I'm eating less of this food because it's less rewarding to me, right? Mm. Now, if that's the case, of course, it begs the obvious question, well, could it be dampening my reward centers for other things like the joys of life, right? So that's one possible theory.
Yeah.
That's disputed. We don't know. We'll know in a few years. I actually think for me, it was something much more basic. I go through in my book, Magic Pill, the five reasons why we eat. Only one of them is the obvious one, to like sustain our bodies, right? The other four are all psychological.
Yeah.
And I had a real epiphany about this in a branch of KFC in Vegas. For people, your listeners will go to Vegas a lot because not so far. It's the KFC on West Sahara, one of the roughest KFCs in the world. It was about 7 months into taking the drugs. I'd taken Ozempic. And I went in. I was in Vegas because there had been developments in something I've been researching for a long time. I'm writing a book about a series of crimes that had been happening in Vegas, and I was researching the murder of someone that I knew and really loved. So as you can imagine, it was painful. And really on autopilot, I went to this branch of KFC and I ordered what I would have ordered before I was taking Ozempic. I ordered a bucket of fried chicken. I ate one of the chicken drumsticks and I suddenly thought, oh, I can't eat all of this. You can't overeat when you're on Ozempic. You would be sick, right? It'd be like, imagine if immediately after you'd had a huge Thanksgiving dinner, I came up to you and said, great news, Doug, I got you a KFC bucket, right? You'd just be like, oh, take it away from me. That's how you feel, right? Yeah. And I remember thinking, you know those moments when you realize something and it's almost like someone else is speaking to you? I thought, oh, you're just going to have to feel bad then. And I realized what these drugs do is they radically interrupt your eating patterns. That's obviously a good thing. It's where you lose weight. It's what you need. But what that can do is bring to the surface some of the deep underlying reasons why we overeat in the first place. Now, again, that can be a good thing. There's clearly better ways for me to deal with distress than Colonel Sanders, right?
Yeah.
But that can be a difficult and painful process. It was for me. An interesting way, I think, if you want to think about the effects of these drugs, both positive and negative,
it actually helps to compare it to a different area of science. Because these drugs have only been around for weight loss for a couple of years. But up to now, the most reliable way to lose huge amounts of weight and keep it off, if diet and exercise doesn't work for you, and it doesn't work for most people, has been bariatric surgery. Things like, you know, gastric bands, gastric sleeves, that kind of thing. So what do we know about bariatric surgery? Well, we know that it's a horrible, grim operation. 1 in 1,000 people die in the operation. It's no joke. But the reason people put themselves through that is because of what happens next. If you have bariatric surgery in the 7 years that follow, you are 56% less likely to die of a heart attack. You are 60% less likely to die of cancer. You are 92% less likely to die of diabetes-related causes. In fact, it's so good for your health, you're 40% less likely to die at all in those 7 years, right? And we now know these new weight loss drugs like Ozempic are bringing us in a similar direction. If you take these drugs and you started with a BMI higher than 27, you are 20% less likely to have a heart attack or stroke in the next 2 years. Incredible. But we also know some of the negative effects apply with bariatric surgery. So with the similarly between bariatric surgery and the new weight loss drugs. So for example, after you have bariatric surgery, you are almost 4 times more likely to kill yourself, which seems really strange, right? But I think it's connected to some of it might be the after effects of the surgery, which can be very physically unpleasant. But I suspect it's because of these deep, you know, if you think about one of the 5 reasons why we eat that I write about in the book, comfort.
Yeah.
If you eat for comfort, for me, I realize going back to when I was very young, stuffing myself was a way I calmed myself down. I soothed myself. And when I could no longer do that on these drugs, there was a period where it was psychologically disorientating, right? And unpleasant. So yeah, it's one of many things that I write about in my book, Magic Pill, that I really wish I'd known about in advance.
We should talk about the story of how this all begins. This is 1984. There's a young Canadian research scientist in Massachusetts General Hospital wants to be a thyroid specialist, but they don't have any thyroid specialties to look at the time. So he's assigned this gene, the glucagon gene. And that seems like sort of the origin moment for this. And he has this kind of aha moment. Would you take us to this part of the story?
So there had been breakthroughs in the 70s in how we can sequence genes. And so they were just going through all the different genes and all the different parts of the human body to see, you know, what's going on there. And they were studying something called the glucagon gene. And at the end of the glucagon gene, there's something called, we now know, GLP-1, something they named GLP-1. But at the time, they didn't even know. So it's like a string. They didn't know, can you break off GLP-1 or is it just part of the string? What does it do? Right. So Daniel, they were dividing up the different bits of the gene for different scientists to study. And he was working in this kind of rickety lab where there were a load of pigeons in the lab above him kept pooping on him, ruining his experiments. He's figuring out what's going on here. So the first thing he figured out is that you can actually break away GLP-1. It doesn't just die if you break it away. So, oh, that's interesting. Okay, it can be broken off the chain. What does it do? So a load of little lab dishes, he starts combining it with other things you find in that part of the body. And he discovered something extraordinary. If you mix GLP-1 with some of the other things that are found in the body, what you discover is it leads to the creation of insulin. Wow, really significant, right? They then did this with rats. The team in Copenhagen in Denmark did it with pigs. They discovered it was right. They discovered a key factor that can stimulate the creation of insulin in people's pancreases, which is how these drugs came to be used for diabetics, right? It's why type 2 diabetics have been using these drugs now for 18, it'll be 19 years in a few months, right? Mm-hmm. So that's how the kind of drugs first originated. But there were then many breakthroughs, and it's a long story, but they basically also discovered, wow, these diabetics seem to lose a lot of weight when they take these drugs, right? What's going on? Mm-hmm. That was when they also discovered that these drugs, okay, GLP-1 is the thing that makes you feel full, or one of the key things that makes you feel full. If we can create a copy of the thing that makes you feel full, will that make you feel fuller for longer? Well, goddammit, it does. I'll rephrase that because I don't want to offend anyone. Well, it really does, right? So that's how we led to this incredible moment. The way one of the scientists put it to me is, you know, We've cracked the treasure chest. We've figured out what regulates human appetite, and it's gut hormones. And if you want a lower appetite, you simulate gut hormones. You create copies of gut hormones and you whack them into people. And the reason why Mounjaro has an even more powerful effect than Ozempic is, so Ozempic injects you with a copy of GLP-1 that sticks around your system for a whole week, as I say. Mounjaro actually simulates two gut hormones, GLP-1 and a different one called GIP, which is why it has an even bigger effect. And there's now over, you know, there's loads of gut hormones that affect appetite. There's now over 200 drugs that are in development to see, you know, okay, if we manipulate different gut hormones, how big an effect do you have on appetite? But really, this is an enormous scientific breakthrough.
There's a cultural part to the story, Johan, that I wanted to ask you about. You have this chapter in the book called The Land That Doesn't Need Ozempic. So let's talk about Japan. It's the only country in the world that, as you say, got rich without getting fat. So tell us why. I think at first people are going to have the same theory you did, which is, well, it's genetics. But that's not the reason. So talk about where Japan fits here.
Most people listening who are overweight or obese, and that will be most people listening, we're facing a dilemma. You've got to weigh the risks of obesity, which are really, really substantial, against the 12 significant risks associated with these drugs that I go through in Magic Pill. And so part of me is thinking, well, this is just the choice human beings face, right? This is just how it's going to be. You know, there's a temptation to think, well, you know, when a country gets rich, as we have in the United States and in Britain and other countries, you're going to have more calories than you can consume healthily. So people are just going to get fat, and now we're going to be stuck in this trap, Ozempic or obesity forever. So the way I began to think of it is almost like we're in a trap and these drugs are a trapdoor. And we're just going to have to all decide for the rest of time whether to go through this trapdoor or not. But then you learn, wait a minute, Japan is the third richest country in the world. And they have almost no obesity. 4% of Japanese people are obese. Almost none of their children are obese, compared to 42.5% of American adults. So it's like, well, what happened? So I went to Japan to figure it out and meet the leading scientists there. And I've got to tell you, Doug, it is the weirdest thing to go to a school with 1,000 children and walk around and realize there is not one fat child at that school. And it's not like this is inevitable. Japan, 120 years ago, had a really unhealthy population, had one of the worst diets in the world. And the Japanese government, through very concerted government action, decided to make their population healthy, to move to a population that eats healthy, fresh food and teaches their children to love healthy food. At every school in Japan, you're not allowed to bring a packed lunch. You have to eat the food the school provides. The school has to provide completely fresh, healthy food. The school has to employ a professional nutritionist who designs the food, has to be prepared on the day. Even the paste that goes with the food has to be freshly prepared on the day. And they use this fresh, healthy food to educate the children about what healthy food does for your body and to love fresh and healthy food. So yeah, there's nothing inevitable about this. We can change the culture to make our kids so they don't have to face the choice between obesity or Ozempic. And if that sounds a bit pie in the sky, think about smoking, right? There's a photograph of me and my mother when I'm 6 months old. She's breastfeeding me, smoking, and resting the ashtray on my stomach. And when I discovered this photo a few years ago, I thought she'd feel guilty. I showed it to her. She said, "You were a difficult baby. I needed that cigarette," right? Now, that sounds insane to us now. In 1979, that was completely normal. If we could take back a contemporary American 7 or 8 year old to the United States or Britain of when we were 7 or 8, the thing that would most shock them is people smoked everywhere, right? People smoked, you know, while they were eating. People smoked on the plane. People smoked on the subway. You know, my doctor used to smoke me while he examined me, right? Like the, now that's completely unthinkable. That changed because we changed the culture, right? So we don't have to accept our children being made physically sick and dying younger. we don't have to tolerate this. We don't have to tolerate this being done to our children. If a foreign adversary did this to our children, if the Russians did it, if Al-Qaeda did it, we would go to nuclear war against them for killing our kids, right? We do not have to tolerate this. It is not inevitable. I went to countries from Mexico to the Netherlands to Japan that have found ways to hugely reduce obesity. We can do the same. Mm. We don't have to be trapped in this choice. And I saw what you gain if you make that choice. You know, I went to a place that sounds almost mythical. It's a village called Ogimi. Mm. It's the oldest village in the world by some measures. It's in Okinawa, the islands in the south of Japan. So it has, I think it's 215 households and more than 190 have someone who's over the age of 90 living there. And I went to their little community center. And the first person I met there was a 103-year-old woman called Matsu Fukuchi, who walked there on her own. She had a stick. She walked slowly, but she walked there. And we spoke, and she talked about how much she enjoyed life. And then someone turned on some Okinawan music, and she put on a kimono, and she started to dance. And I danced with these 103-year-old women. And I thought, you were born before they started doing radio broadcasts in Japan, and I'm recording my interview and I was dancing on my iPhone. This is what you get if you sort out the obesity crisis. Okay, not everyone lives to be 103, obviously, but you get to have many more years of joy and love and dancing. That's what we get if we sort out this crisis, right?
Johann Hari, we're talking about his new book, Magic Pill, The Extraordinary Benefits and Disturbing Risks of the New Weight Loss Drugs. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the writer and journalist Johann Hari. We're talking about his new book, Magic Pill. Let's talk about where you ended up in what you describe as your inner conflict about these weight loss drugs. You say in the book, of course, it's still complex, but that it started to become increasingly clear. And a few of the convictions you mention, maybe you can go through some of these. One is you say we need to radically change the kind of food we're given from an early age. You write about the fact that we need to fight to change the culture.
Yeah.
But also that we do need to be realistic about dealing with the world as it is. So people should weigh the risks of being obese against the risks of these drugs. So where have you ended up? I mean, you sort of, it's interesting in the book, you mentioned that you felt like you had sort of come to this sort of moral finale. You weighed the risks and the benefits for yourself, and you came to the conclusion you're going to stay with it, with these drugs.
So the first thing I would say is I'm not a doctor. Everyone who's thinking of this should talk very carefully with their doctor.
Right.
But the truth is, this is complicated. The risks of obesity are complicated, and the 12 big risks associated with these drugs are complicated. I've come to the conclusion that some people should definitely be taking these drugs, and some people should definitely not take these drugs. Mm. And I would really recommend that you go through the evidence, that people listen and go through the evidence in my book, Magic Pill, to sort of see which of these apply to them and then discuss it with their doctor.
Yeah. And you go through the risks, we should mention too, and people should go through that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And some of the risks are very serious. I mean, the way I think about these drugs is they're a bit like fire. Fire is a really powerful tool. And fire is a great tool if I use it to keep my house warm, and it's a terrible tool if I use it to burn down your house. Yeah. And these tools are so powerful. So for people like me with heart disease in their family, this is probably saving my life, right? Given how many men in my family have heart attacks, and given how big the reduction in heart attacks is when you take these drugs, that for me was the thing that decided it. For me, that outweighs the 12 significant risks that I describe in the book. But there's other people for whom the calculation will be completely different. If you have thyroid cancer in your family, I would urge you to be very cautious because there's some evidence suggesting these drugs may increase the risk of thyroid cancer. If you're planning to or thinking or just might by accident get pregnant, be very cautious because we know that when you give these drugs to rats, they're significantly more likely to have babies with birth deformities. There's a whole lot of risks. If you have ever had an eating disorder, you know, the thing I'm most worried about for the society is what this will do to young girls with eating disorders, many of whom, if we don't regulate this more tightly, I think we could have an opioid-like death toll of young girls who use these drugs to starve themselves to death who would not have been able to had they not got hold of these drugs. So it's really complicated. Anyone who's saying to you about these drugs, yay, they're the best thing in the world, they're just going to save us all, or boo, they're the devil, get rid of them, I think is missing the much more complicated and interesting question, which is that we've got a staggeringly powerful new tool, and we're going to have to weigh and regulate this tool very carefully. And we're all going to have to think super carefully about what we want to decide with this, what we want for our loved ones. And there is no one-size-fits-all answer to that. We're going to have to think about it super, super carefully.
Do you think you'll ever feel completely normal again while you're taking Ozempic? And by that I mean you mentioned the side effects, the nauseous feeling you have every few days, the sense of being lightheaded, feeling these muted emotions, that sort of, you write about this nagging notion that you feel that your body's telling you something might be, like, will that ever go away? And will you ever feel normal again? I mean, clearly you're thinking in your own life it's worth, at least right now, what we know, it's worth it. But does that ever worry you?
Oh, no, it has gone away. So it's a year and a half now since I started taking the drugs, and those side effects have worn off. So for most people, when they start to take these drugs, the side effects are quite unpleasant. You feel nauseous, you feel tired. Not everyone, but a lot of people. For me, those side effects have gone away, which is great. Of course, some of the 12 big risks that I wrote about in the book may play out over time again, and we don't know the long-term effects of these drugs. It's one of the things that most worries me. So, you know, it could be someone will find this radio show 20 years from now when we know more and think, well, what a fool, he was ruling out the long-term effects. Although, as one of the obesity specialists I interviewed, Dr. Shauna Levy, put it to me, we don't know the long-term risks of these drugs. We do know the long-term risks of obesity, and they are very serious. And I have been obese almost all my adult life. I would have continued to be obese. I had tried diet and exercise. Of course, everyone should try diet and exercise first because it's much less risky. But I've never met a fat person who hasn't tried diet and exercise. Don't know about you. So yeah, I'd say I do feel normal now. I feel a lot more normal than I did when I was obese, and I feel a lot more normal than I did when I was first taking Ozempic. But there was a pretty bumpy patch there where it was quite unpleasant.
But you say you feel like you physically healed. You feel more agile, more free, you walk faster. I mean, that's something.
It's huge. It's absolutely huge. You know, obesity is a really... obesity is painful. It hurts your back. It hurts your knees. I think a lot about a guy called Jeff Parker, who I interviewed. He's a 67-year-old retired lighting engineer in San Francisco who was very overweight. He was in a lot of pain. He was taking fistfuls of pills every day. He started to take Mounjaro. Now, all that pain's gone away. He's come off almost all his pills, and he walks his dog over the Golden Gate Bridge every day. There's a lot of people like Jeff who I would strongly urge to take these drugs. And then there's a lot of people who I would strongly urge not to take the drugs. But for the people for whom it's working, my God, it's a staggering, life-transforming, beautiful moment of liberation, and we should not underestimate or undersell that. The people who experience the benefits are stunning. I mean, I wasn't as obese as Jeff, so it's not as big a life transformation for me, but even for someone like me, and I was, you know, I was 42 pounds heavier than I am now, it's a big change. It's a big change, and one for the better.
Johan Hari, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much. What great questions. You read the book really closely. Thanks so much, Doug.
That's the writer and journalist Johann Hari. His new book is called Magic Pill: The Extraordinary Benefits and Disturbing Risks of the New Weight Loss Drugs. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West. Or you can just email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Katrina Cano. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.